Because I'm sure as you sit in your seats and look at me, you think I'm like most of you. I was born in Minnesota too long ago. And I was brought up in Minnesota, but something happened to me along the way. I don't know exactly what it was. Maybe I'll have time to figure that out while I'm here at Golden Village. But I became very interested in Native Americans, Indian people. Different people give different names to the people who lived on our continent before most of us, before most of our parents or grandparents or whoever came here to this place. And I studied at the University of Minnesota and did my field work with Indian people in the Southwest. And since that time, I have worked with Indian people. Indian people in the United States and in Central America, in countries like Guatemala, Salvador, and Nicaragua, where I live now. And so when I discovered that I would be coming to Holden Village when the theme would be a whole new world, I decided that one of the themes that I would want to work on while I'm here is what is the new world? Whose new world? And what I want to do is share with you tonight and perhaps over the next few days for those who will be interested in coming back. I want to be a voice for those voices who are often not heard. These people who have been the most important part of my life for the last 30 years, the Indian people of the Americas. And that's why I say, although we look alike, I don't feel that I'm the same as all of you, because my life experiences have brought me to a different understanding of the history of the people of our country and our continent. So, while Cindy is looking at the kin, how do you say it in English? Quinto centenario? That's Spanish. Quincentenary. She's looking at it from the point of view of Europeans. I want to look at what happened from the point of view of the people of the Americas. All over Europe and the United States, people are celebrating 500 years, 500 years of so-called discovery. And lots of people are saying, oh, what a wonderful thing. Columbus discovered America. Well, I would like, from a Latin American point of view, to say that most Latin Americans are not celebrating the coming of Columbus, or the so-called discovery of America. They were already here. And most people who are doing anything about the 500 years are talking about a commemoration. And some people are asking that we not repeat what had happened in the past. And yet, what I think we'll discover as we go through this week together is that exactly what we are doing is repeating much of history. I think that what I would like to do is to denounce what has happened. And I'm doing this because my option has been an option for the poor, an option for those who have been the victims. And these victims of yesterday of 500 years ago continue to be, in many places, even here, the victims today. I don't want to talk about the good guys and the bad guys, because I don't think that that's the point. The point is not to alienate one another. I think that it's just that there's another vision that's important to have, and that's the vision of people from autochthonous societies being able to maintain their community values and the importance of that versus the irrationality of capitalism. There have been a number of articles that have been written about the commemoration of the 500 years from the point of view of Latin Americans. And I have translated some things, and with Cindy, we hope to prepare a poster, a series of posters, to share with you about the 500 years. I couldn't print on the computer today, so I'll have to do that tomorrow. But what I want to do is share with you a little bit about the encounter of the cultures, which is another way of looking at the discovery. One of my friends here gave me a tip just a few minutes ago. He said that he was listening to his shortwave radio, and today is a very significant day. Today is the anniversary of the day when Columbus set forth from Spain. Is that right? So it's significant that this is the day we begin this discussion. So let's talk about the encounter of the cultures. What does that mean? What did it mean for the people who lived here? It meant ransacking. In the first 150 years of colonization, from the mines of the Americas to the ports of Spain, there arrived 185,000 kilos of gold and 35 million pounds of pure silver. Now, what does that mean? I mean, that's a lot, however you look at it, right? But what it means is that no bank in all of Europe at that time had as much money as that signified. Never in the history of humanity had such a large sum of money been accumulated in such short a period of time. And this accumulation of capital permitted the development of what we know as the European community of today. So, the economic development of Europe depended upon what was taken out of the Americas. In other words, Europe carried out the biggest robbery known to mankind. Genocide. In 1492, when Columbus discovered America, 70 million peoples lived in the Americas. But over 150 years, 65 million victims were taken in different ways. Let me tell you some of the ways. In the mines of what is now Bolivia, thousands upon thousands of people died because they worked day and night until their lungs burst to take the ore out of the ground. those 65 million victims is significant when you break it down, because we're talking about 500,000 victims a year and 1,000 people dying every day. Dying because of hard labor, dying because of disease, diseases that were unknown in this continent. And people died of them because they had no resistance to these diseases. And they continue to die from these diseases today. So, during that period of time then, we see that the population was reduced to practically a tenth of what it was at the time of the so-called discovery, the arrival of the Spanish. In just 20 years' time, the people who inhabited the islands in the Caribbean, the Antilles Islands, now the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Cuba, in just 20 years, those Indian people were exterminated. In 20 years. The Spanish colony was able to develop a slave labor force that was one of the largest in the history of mankind. But what we see, the result, is what I think we can call genocide. Another encounter of the cultures resulted in invasion. On the 12th of October of 1492, these lands were militarily occupied by the Spanish. And this initiated 300 years of foreign domination. In 1521, Hernan Cortes destroyed completely the foundations of the major capital of the continent, which was Tenochtitlan in Mexico. In 1533, Francisco Pizarro, who was an illiterate pig farmer, destroyed the fabulous Temple of the Sun in Cuzco, in the heart of the Incan Empire. In 1562, in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, a priest, Fray Diego de Landa, burned all of the writings, the literature, the science of the Mayan people, the most advanced culture that lived here in America. And what did they do? To maintain the people below the domination, they buried the cultures of the people. Even in 1780, the governor of the Viceroy of Peru prohibited the Quechua and the Aymara people, from using their traditional clothing. They were not permitted to comb their hair the way they combed their hair. They weren't able to play their musical instrument, the quena. They could not celebrate their festivals, their ancient festivals. They had to dress, to comb their hair, and to speak as the Spanish spoke. This was the conquest. What about the church? The indigenous people of Latin America were massively and forcibly baptized. They were Christianized so that they could become subjects of the king of the Spanish Empire. They were obligated legally to forced labor and to pay taxes as subjects of the Spanish Empire. Those that didn't accept baptism were stabbed, or they were burned at the stake, or they were persecuted in other ways. this form of evangelization, of living Indians, converted them into dead Christians. I know all this is pretty grim, but it's pretty grim what happened. And I think some of you have been in Cindy's group. Was anybody here this morning when we saw the Columbus myth? Well, I think that we have to hear these things. These things have to be denounced. And some of us who have lived and worked in Latin America and who have come to identify ourselves with the Latin American people feel that we have an obligation to speak out and to say these things, to say these things that people don't know. We need to let Christian people know that in the name of Christianity, a great number of things were done. I think one of the important things about all of this is that, as I said, a lot of what has happened continues to be happening, and during this week, perhaps we can delve into that a little bit more. Excuse me a minute. Today, in 1492, the conqueror was the Spanish Empire. Today, there's another conqueror, and it's the United States. There's a little change between what was done by the Spanish at the time of the conquest, Western Christian culture, and what is being done by the United States in Latin America today. There is still domination, there is still oppression, and it is still masked by an ideology. In the time of the Spanish, the ideology that masked the domination was the Christian church. And today, the domination is masked by promises of riches and talk about democracy. I don't want to necessarily get into all of that today, because what I hope to do over the next few days is share with you testimonies in different moments of the history of the people of the Americas, beginning long, long before Columbus ever came to the Americas, and sharing creation stories, and sharing beautiful stories of the history and the lives of the people of the Americas, and then what happened to them. Domination requires liberation, and many of us feel that the struggles for liberation in Central America in particular, not only are liberating the people of the Americans, but they can liberate the others too, the people who were the conquerors. Domination requires liberation, requires an unmasking. And in this case, what we're going to discover is not a new world, but discover this government, that which conquered. The reality of Spain, the reality of Western culture, and the reality of the church. It is the third world today that's discovering the first world. Discovering the first world in its negative aspects and discovering the first world in a real way. Don't you think it would be interesting, and most of you are Lutherans, and the Lutheran Church has a statement calling 1992 the year of remembrance, repentance, and renewal. Do some of you know this statement? I think that Cindy leaves her things over there in the corner, and she has the statement, but she has it in the materials. But it would be good for you all to have an opportunity to read this, because if you're here, you're obviously interested in the 500 years. And it calls for solidarity and advocacy of Native Americans. I just want to stop for a minute and ask you what that word means to you. When we say the word Americans, what comes to your mind? Anybody?
United States.
USA.
Mm-hmm. United States.
I think it's wider than that. Mm-hmm. Caribbean, Canadians are American.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a continent.
Uh-huh.
Power.
Power.
Individualistic.
Mm-hmm. Any other words?
I think we're just the ugly Americans. I mean, we get the blindfold.
What else?
I think of North and South Americans.
Why do you? Why?
Maybe because I do international work and I've been informed that that's the way it is. I mean, when I have to put down somebody's citizenship, I put down USA rather than America, because it doesn't include, you know, people think of Americans as just us.
Yes, I think that one of the interesting things that has happened to me over the years is discovering who are the Americans, right? And it's because of international work, because we learn as young people in our primary school that we are Americans, but we think of U.S. citizenship as Americans. And people, when they go abroad to Europe, for example, they talk about being American. And whenever I hear somebody say they're an American, and I know they're a U.S. citizen, it sort of hits me, right? Because all of the Americans, all the people of Americas are American, not U.S. citizens, not just U.S. citizens. And so when we talk about Americans, Native Americans, we're talking about Indian people from North America, from Canada and the United States, from Central America, and from South America. People who lived here thousands and thousands of years before any white Anglo-Saxon Americans even dreamed there was such a place. So I think we have to start from there. What is it to be an American, to discover what is America. You know, I live in Central America, and there are these special rates for coming to visit the United States, and they're called Discover America. Discover America. And they're American Airlines, or United Airlines, or Delta, or whatever, but they all have their Discover America programs for people from South America and for Central America. Mm-hmm. And nobody asks that question, you know, why is it just the United States that's called America? Well, I think that what we want to do during this commemoration of the 500 years is discover America in its fullest sense. And to help third world people help first world people discover what happened. There was a Catholic priest, a Spanish priest, who lived in El Salvador and who died in El Salvador, assassinated, the rector of the university. And he wrote that if the prophet, the third world, does not tell the truth, the first world will not be capable of seeing and discovering their own reality and will continue to tell the third world what to do. So, Spain, why did Spain come here? Do you have any idea?
God and gold.
God and gold.
I think gold.
Gold.
What do you think came first? China.
Gold.
Gold. Because of the, they had just come through their years of war and they had to recoup.
But they didn't just come here. The Portuguese, they discovered in Africa and they went all the way around. But obviously they thought, they felt the world was still flat, of course, and Galileo said it was round and then took it back that it was flat. But they had it for money.
For money, for riches.
For riches and money, yeah.
And for power.
But they did need the money to recover.
Yes. Yes. Well, they got lots of it. They got lots of it.
How much of that was through trade, though? Through items that may have been brought over through trade? Is that just pillaged and taken? You're saying?
Yes. Yes.
Where do you get these statistics?
These statistics come out of different books from Latin America, written by Latin American and Spanish historians. People like Fray Bartolomé de las Casas, a Catholic priest who came here to the Americas, was a rich land. He came first as a landlord, and then was converted. I mean, decided to become a priest, and as a priest, became the defender of the Indian people, and wrote what is called a brief history of the Indies. It's not very brief, it's three volumes. But it's the history of the conquest and what he saw and what he cried out against and denounced in his time. And a lot of it comes from his writings and subsequent writings from Latin America. I can't give you all the sources right now, but they are available.
Does he include all the amounts that ended up on the bottom of the ocean through some ships?
Well, we're talking about what ended up in the treasuries of what ended up in the treasuries, what was counted over there. You know, just as an aside, when those of us who were working in development projects and health projects in Latin America work with people from first world countries, from the United States, from Canada, from Western Europe, in preparing projects for funding. I spend a lot of my time doing that. I run an organization with 54 people and four different offices, and we require funding to be able to do that. And our funding comes, we are a non-governmental agency, and our funding comes from European and other funding sources. And one of the things that we have been trying to do over the past few years is work in the concientización, or the building of awareness of people from the first world countries about the reality, the history of the peoples with whom we work. And one of the things that we have tried to do is develop partnerships instead of relationships that are dependency relationships. And we do that because we believe that the people in the first world have an obligation not to help poor people in Latin America or in third world countries, but as countries that were colonizers, and countries that sack these countries, these poor countries of the South, were not poor countries. They were rich countries. And those riches were taken to what at the time were poor countries, you know? To Spain, to France, to Belgium, to England, and permitted the development of the grand empires. And so when today we ask for development aid for third world countries, we're not asking for something for charity. We're asking people to be conscious of the responsibility to return to many of the people that which was taken away from them. And so it's not a relationship of charity, it's a relationship of partnership and responsibility. And some people find that hard to accept. You know, people like to be charitable. But the other thing that needs to be said is that for all of the money that goes to the developing countries of the world, out of every dollar that's spent in a third world country, $2 or $3 comes back to the country that gives that money. How is that? Because if we have a project, for example, with Belgium, many times the only materials that can be provided for that project have to come from Belgian companies. This happens all the time in the United States. But because I live in a country that for nearly 10 years was blockaded by the United States, I can't give you all the facts about United States, United States and its requirements. Now that USAID is back in Nicaragua, that will develop again. You have development aid, but you use US products. Well, we couldn't do that for the years we were under the blockade. But it's true not just of the United States, it's true of all the countries of Western Europe. The strings that are attached to development aid, and the strings that are attached to charitable aid as well. So this is part of telling the truth, part of uncovering and discovering what has happened in the world.
Well, what about when people develop in that country? How much does the local governments give before the people ever get it? I mean, is there a problem with, I know this happened in the African countries. All kinds of assistance is gone, but the people don't see it.
That's right. People don't see it because of the corruption.
Yeah,
because
local,
of other people wanting to have power.
The local people in control and won't let it down to the people.
That's true. What you say is very true. And it happens in many countries. And when people fight corruption, when people speak out against corruption, then those people can often lose their lives. Because when the truth is told, there are too many people who don't want the truth to be told because that hurts their own pockets. Hmm? There's something else I wanted to share with you, because in contrast to the Lutheran Church and the statement of the Lutheran Church, the indigenous people of the Americas have also prepared their statement, and they have made a declaration. And during this year of commemoration of 500 years, there are activities taking place throughout the Americas with Indian people from North, Central, and South America. People met in Quito, in Ecuador, in July of 1990, and they prepared the Declaration of the Indigenous Peoples, Native Peoples. And this is what they said. I'm translating all this. I did the translation, and I'm going to make it available. I'm going to be putting it up somewhere. But as I said, I couldn't use the printer today. So, the Indian peoples have said this. We roundly reject the celebration of 500 years. The quincent, how do you say it?
I can't
say
quincent.
It in English. Quincentenary. We ratify our political project of self-determination and the conquest of our autonomy. in the framework of national states under a new popular order. Do you understand what that means? There are many Indian nations. We have Indian nations in the United States. There are Indian nations in Central America and South America, in Canada as well. All over the Americas, there are Indian nations. And they believe that they should have self-determination. They are not asking to be separate states. They're talking about self-determination within established national states. No. For example, in Nicaragua, and I should say that my children are Indians. My children are Mosquito Indians from the northeastern section of Nicaragua. You will have seen them around here. They're brown skin, beautiful people. And they're the people of the Mosquito Nation, and the Sumo Nation, and the Rama Indian people have their autonomy as part of a long process that took place during the years of the Sandinista government. And today, the autonomy of those Indian people of Nicaragua is threatened by the new government, who does not recognize the elected leaders. Now, Nicaragua is the only country in the world where Indian people were given autonomy. And it took a long time and a long struggle, even under a progressive revolutionary government, to come to this point. And the first thing that the new government of Nicaragua did was to set up a ministry of the Atlantic coast, which goes against the whole process of autonomy and does not recognize the elected leaders. And so in Nicaragua, even though there are people who among the Indians voted for the Chamorro government, the Indian people together, people who were counter-revolutionaries, people who fought with the Sandinistas, all of the Indian people are working together to maintain that autonomy and to demand from the Chamorro government that she respects the autonomy of the Indian people. So that's what Indian people all over the Americas are asking for, that they have self-determination within national states. You know, they're not going to be a group of Indians having their own state within Bolivia, for example, but that the Bolivian government recognize the autonomy and the right to self-determination of Indian people. This is true in Guatemala, this is true in Ecuador, and in other places where there are many Indians. Now do you understand?
Can you tell us how that would work?
Especially in this country.
It will work differently in each state, because they would have to come to agreements with the national, with the state, with these countries, with the governments of these countries. So I can't say how it would be everywhere. But the idea is that Indian people could elect their own officials, their own governors, their own mayors, their own representatives, and they would also elect their representatives to the state government, where their elected representatives could then express the will, the collective will of their people. This is the way it was envisioned in Nicaragua, where there was an autonomy process. Most Indian nations do not even have the possibility of discussing with their governments what would be the self-determination of their people, right?
Could I ask you, just for background, what's population Nicaragua, and what percentage are Indian, what percentage are mixed blood, Spanish and Indian, what percentage pure Spanish? Ballpark numbers, we get a frame when we're talking about numbers.
There are no pure Spanish anywhere.
Gone.
Anywhere in Latin America.
Well, one time there were.
Well, yes.
And some of them they had. So what I'm saying is, well, there's still some in Mexico and a few places, but I mean, basically there are no Spanish that intermarried, right?
Well, once you're intermarried, you're not just Spanish anymore.
No, I know that.
You're so mestizo people.
Then you're going to, what do you, mix
but when we talk about Indians, we're talking about people who identify as Indian.
Give me a percent.
In Nicaragua.
Yeah.
In Nicaragua, about 50,000 out of 4 million people identify themselves clearly
as
Indian people.
And then
but in Guatemala, we have close to 6 million people, and over half of them, define themselves as Indians, and others define themselves as Latinos. But if you put them in the same room, the only difference would be one would wear a costume and speak the language, and others would not. But they're Indian people. But why they identify themselves as Latinos, or why they identify themselves as Spanish, has a lot to do with racism and little to do with blood.
Okay.
But when I talk about the Declaration of the Indian Nations, I'm talking about people who clearly identify themselves as Indians, who have no problem with saying I'm an Indian. No? Now, a lot of people have a problem with saying I'm an Indian because saying you're an Indian means that you're subject to different rules and regulations, right? Another thing that the Declaration of Indian Nations is asking for is a respect for the right to life. A respect for the right to life. That means stopping genocide against Indians. A right to land, a right to organize freely, and a right to express our culture. How many of you have read the Bill of Rights? All of you. Does it sound too different? Why do people have to demand a right to life, to land, to freedom of expression, to freedom of practicing their religion? It's because they don't have it. They have to demand it. And why don't they have it? When we talk about that this is our Bill of Rights, we consider vital the defense and conservation of natural resources that are within our territories and actually in this time are being exploited by transnational companies. We talked the other evening about the Indian people of the Southwest, about the Navajos and Hopi Indians who are being moved off their land so that transnational companies can freely exploit the minerals that are in that land. Now remember, when we talk about the earth with Indian people, we're talking about our mother. Our mother is the earth, and we are taking things out of the earth. We are destroying our mother, and the Indians feel very strongly about this. And the fact that there are transnational companies doing it, if people begin to complain, even in this country, people disappear when they complain about these sort of things. You would never do it in Guatemala because you have your village burned down. We recognize the importance of the role of the Indian woman in the struggle of our people. Now, a lot of us are very happy about that. Those of us who are feminists feel strongly about the importance of Indian women. In many cultures, in many Indian cultures, the women have been the leaders and the backbone of the Indian communities. There's a book here in the resource center, Spider Grandmother's Stories, I think is the name of it. I'm not sure. But there are some very beautiful Indian stories about women. And women have been very important in the struggle for Indian people. And one of the Indians who is in the forefront at the present time is a Guatemalan Indian from Quiché. and her name is Rigoberto Menchú. The other evening, Cindy read something from Rigoberto. Rigoberto Menchú is a young Indian woman who saw her family killed. I knew her father. Her father was a catechist, and he worked with a group of health leaders, health promoters, and I worked with them. And her father was burned to death, along with a number of other Indians, in the Spanish embassy in 1980. And that's all very close to me, and I perhaps will share that some other day. But Rigoberta told her story. It's been translated. And today Rigoberta Menchú is being nominated for the Nobel Prize for Peace. And many of us feel it's important to work for her candidacy. But we were told that if we worked for it, this was being political, and that it would endanger her being given the Nobel Peace Prize if people in the Americas spoke out in favor of her nomination. I don't understand that. I don't understand. Maybe some of you can explain to me why it's wrong to support her nomination. We think it's right, and we hope that Rigoberto Menchú will be recognized and be given this prize for peace, because a prize for peace for Rigoberto Menchú would be a recognition of the struggle of Indian peoples, and particularly the struggle of Indian women. We demand bilingual and intercultural education for all sectors of the society, not just for Indians, but that our Americas are made up of many people. And in the morning, in the Bible study that I was in, we talked about where we came from. Were some of you in Bible study? I think you did it in both sessions, right? In Bible study, we talked about where we came from. And many people here come from a background where people speak German or Polish or Norwegian or Swedish. But do many of you speak those languages? Most of you don't. And when Spanish-speaking people or Indian people try to preserve their languages, the educational system has tried to destroy those languages, has punished children for speaking their language in a school, because that is not the language of the school. And so the Indians are not saying that they want only to speak their language. They're saying that all of society, all people, all cultures should have intercultural education and bilingual education. If people want to know the language of their forefathers and mothers, they have the right to know and express themselves in that language. And one evening on CNN News in Nicaragua, I listened to congressmen in the United States deciding whether ballots should be printed in two languages. And I listened to congressmen say that Spanish-speaking people, who are the majority of people in many counties in the United States, that those people should learn to read and write Spanish and vote in the English and vote in English language. And I find that extremely offensive.
It's the international language, though.
Correct.
But in Washington State, they have Spanish teachers in all the elementary schools.
But we're saying that people have the right.
In Southern California also.
Yeah, they have their own language.
They do, because people have fought to have bilingual education programs. But I lived in the state of Texas for 5 years and worked with migrant workers many years ago. And during the time that I was there, children were punished in the county where I lived, in the United States, for speaking Spanish in West Texas schools until groups of Spanish-speaking political activists were able to have bilingual education. So they're not saying that people should not speak other languages, but people have the right to their own language. We have the right to our own language. I mean, if somebody came here and said, we don't want you to speak English anymore, we want you to speak our language because we dominated you, I don't think that many of you would accept that readily, would you? But this is what's happening in many parts of the world. But the Indian nations are not asking for an exclusive language. They're asking that education and language and cultural studies be developed for all peoples everywhere. Another part of the declaration says, we reaffirm the right to practice our beliefs and to have our sacred places. Instead of celebrating 500 years, the churches should ask pardon and share our pain. I think we are in a sacred place. And it was a sacred place long, long before it was part of the Lutheran Church. Don't you feel that way? We are in an awesome place. And God is here. And the Indian people knew that too. And this place and many places are sacred. They become sacred to us, and we want to preserve them, and people have worked hard to make this a sacred place for Christian people from the United States. But long before, I'm sure that this was a sacred place for people who call their God by a different name, but it's the same God of all creation, and we have to respect that. We reject the payment of the external debt, and we demand indemnization for genocide, for massacres, and for the sacking of our people. Many people feel that third world debt is unpayable. Few people refuse to pay it. Few countries refuse to pay it. The Indians are saying that it is unpayable and it's unjust to demand that it be paid, because what should be paid is indemnization. And we have a very real complaint about this in Nicaragua, because the World Court determined that the U.S. government should pay indemnizations to the Nicaraguan people for the war that took place for so many years. And the one demand of the U.S. government to the Chamorro government was to take away that claim in the World Court. And she did. She did it so that aid could go to Nicaragua. Many of us think that's wrong, because there's no way that those lives should have been taken, and that there's an obligation on the part of the United States for all the war crimes that were committed in Nicaragua in the time of the Sandinistas. And this has happened to many other people as well. We support the carrying out of a people's tribunal to judge the crimes that were committed during these 500 years of invasion. And that the 12th of October no longer be called the Day of the Discovery, or the Dia de la Raza, which they say in Spanish, the Day of the Race, but that it should be called a Day of Mourning for the destruction of our people and of our culture. This then is the declaration of the pueblo, of the Indian nations. And with that, I would like to close my session tonight, reflecting on these demands, and hope that some of these demands can become reality, that it doesn't take 500 more years to bring justice and peace to the Indian nations of the Americas. During the next few days, we will be having testimonies taken, as I said, from pre-Columbian history, from the time of Columbus and the conquerors, and from present-day Latin America. I invite you to come back and share with me.